Good evening. I'm Fiona Branton, president of the Harvard Law School Forum, and I'd like to welcome you all here tonight. Our guest tonight is truly one of the funniest people I've met. She is best known as the author of a thrice-weekly humor column entitled At Wit's End, which appears in 900 newspapers throughout the world and is read by an estimated 31 million people. The target of her column is usually the family, and I guess almost everyone can identify with the types of situations that she writes about. Irma Bombeck has done a lot of other things since she got her start writing obituaries and weather forecasts for the Dayton Journal Herald in her hometown. She's written 8 books. She's been named to the list of the 25 most influential women in America by the World Almanac 7 times. She's a graduate of the University of Dayton, and she holds 12 honorary doctorates. She's a member of the Society of Professional Journalists, and in 1978, she was appointed by President Carter to serve on the Women's Advisory Committee for Women. Or the President's Advisory Committee for Women, sorry. She was a regular on ABC's Good Morning America for 11 years. She created, wrote, and produced a sitcom named Maggie for ABC, and she has appeared on the cover of Time magazine. She's even been a Grand Marshal in the Rose Parade. Irma Bombeck is currently working on a book on a more serious topic for the American Cancer Society concerning children with cancer. She has 3 grown children, and she lives with her husband in Arizona, and she travels an awful lot. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very pleased to present a distinguished journalist and a very funny woman, Ms. Irma Bombeck.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I've never really addressed a fireplace before. It's weird, truly weird. Having me speak to a group of law students is probably about as ludicrous as assigning an Avon lady to Tammy Baker. I don't know what I could possibly add, but I'll try. I don't speak on campuses very often. I figure if students wanted this kind of guilt, they could call their mothers. But so you're probably asking, so why am I here? Well, a couple of years ago, I attended my son's graduation at the University of Southern California, and the graduation speaker was very eloquent, and he said, "You can climb every mountain, ford every stream, travel every highway, till you find your dream." And he couldn't find his car after graduation. So he had taken a rather eclectic curriculum, transcendental bowling, history of the croissant, holistic car repairs, which really were invaluable, and a variety of cinema classes that were to make him a legend in his own time. But I feel that with all the education, he had missed something very important. He came out of school believing that the most important thing in his life was that he was going to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. He was going to travel extensively and give lectures all over the world. He would probably have a chair endowed for him at the university and be interviewed by Johnny, Phil, Oprah, Sally, Jesse, Larry, and Geraldo in the same day. Now, I hated to depress the kid, as I really hate to depress all of you here this evening, but I have seen your future, and I am it. I'm sorry. In spite of the fact that all of you will have wonderful careers, most of you will live ordinary lives just like the ones I write about. Most of you will get married and buy a car that will not outlast the payments. You are going to have babies that cry all night and sleep all day. You will spend $20,000 to have the teeth of your kid fixed, who will never smile anyway. You'll take the family camping, where you're going to be parking next to a public toilet and do your laundry in a saucepan, and then you'll ride home and tell everyone what a terrific time you had camping. And you'll probably come very close to divorce at some time in your life when your spouse lands on Park Place and charges you $4,000 for the rent. And you know something? Those are going to be the happiest days of your life. And I'm telling you all this because when I lived it, I didn't for a minute believe it either. I think I had to set it all down on paper before I really realized what I really had. The thing about humorists, just a few insights tonight, is that we're never what we seem to be. I think people imagine that we sit around all the time laughing at life's little detours and just really having a really swell time. I wish all this were true. All my life, I don't speak for Buchwald and Baker and the others, but all my life I have worried about every little thing you can imagine. Always have, I always will. I worry about accepting a drink from a urologist with a great sense of humor. I worry about loaning my car to someone to whom I'm related. I worry about Princess Di losing her hat during Harry's delivery. And I have to constantly remind myself that as the Pope once said, or maybe it was Paul Harvey, it was one of them, that a man does not live by somberness alone. He does need a little bit of humor in his life. And my ambition to become a humorist actually surfaced one day in Centerville, Ohio in 1965. And I was on my knees in the utility room, true story, and I was sorting socks when my small son came in and he said, "My socks don't match." And I said, I can't help it. That's all the washer gave me back. And he said, I really do not understand this. If you put a pair of socks in the washer and only one comes back, where does the other sock go? And I said, it went to live with Jesus. And he said to me, "You don't know anything." And I looked in the mirror and the kid was absolutely right. I was 37 years old with a husband who had married me during a commercial break in the World Series. I had two sons, Cain and Abel, and a daughter who would grow up to found the Dan Rather Charm School. And my role model was absolutely the Statue of Liberty. I couldn't imagine anyone having a 35-inch waist and upper arms that could hold 185 tourists. I thought that was great. I was really caught up in the life of suburbia, as a few of the women in the audience is tonight. My husband watched 187 televised football games a weekend. He had seen, true, had seen more bulls than the latrine officer at Fort Dix. I burped Tupperware. I sat around, I crocheted these little serapes and hats for my Tabasco sauce. And my kids never ate anything that had not danced on television. So it was incredible being a mother, because I can remember getting up in mornings in Centerville, Ohio, and my kids would say, "I'm in a school play, I need a costume." And I'd say, "What is a mother for? What are you?" And they'd say, "I'm a participle." You know. So I lived across the street from Phil Donahue, whom I only mention his name just to impress you. It was back in the 60s, and he had five kids, and we had three, and our careers were starting to build at that moment. He had a show called Conversation Piece on radio, and it was really glamorous. He was interviewing all these people who went through our state, and I, on the other hand, was gathering this questionable material for a humor column. And I always noticed whenever they wanted housewives to feel really terrific about themselves, they would say, you know, "I was a nurse, a chauffeur, a cook, a financier, a mistress, and a teacher." But there were a lot of jobs I did that really defied a category. I remember one day one of my kids swallowed a nickel, and I was ready to write it off, you know. was no big deal. But my mother was horrified, and she said, "You take that child to the doctor and have him x-rayed. You will never forgive yourself if something happens." So I walked into this doctor's office. Now, I'm a college graduate. I have a degree in English. I mean, we're not dealing with some nothing here. And I walked in, and he looked at me with a straight face, and he said, "Mrs. Bombeck, I want you to watch his stool." And I said, "Why would I want to do that?" And he said, "Well, don't you want to know where the nickel is?" And I said, "Really, not that bad. I have an independent income." But what we did, we did just a lot of gross things in those times. I can remember taking knots out of shoestrings with my teeth that the kid had wet on all day long. And then about 15 years ago, a very funny thing happened to me on the way to the utility room. A woman's revolution broke out in this country, and someone had the wisdom to figure out that we were equal to a lot of benefits that men were getting. And after all, we figured that Ginger Rogers did every dance Fred Astaire did. She only did it backwards and in high heels. So I think it was evident that women were sick of fighting the wax buildup and the ring around the collar. They were women like I was, who was at an awkward age of their life. I was too old for a paper route, too young for Social Security, and too tired for an affair. So they had another life left in them, and another life to give, and they really wanted to trade up. They were women who had been invisible, and I felt like one of them, because my kids would come home at night and stare me right in the eyeball and say, "Anyone home?" So I didn't wait to be drafted. I joined the revolution for equality, because when my grandchildren asked what I did in the sexual revolution, I didn't want to say I gave it the office. So I hit the trail for the Equal Rights Amendment, which I referred to as the most misunderstood 24 words since one size fits all. And I understand you had Ellie Schmiel here, the speaker of, what, a couple weeks ago? I was with her in Atlanta. We had a meeting that four first ladies had called, and we were delving into the Constitution, and I think that's what it was called, the Constitution, of which we're not in it. And the four first ladies were Mrs. Ford, Ms. Johnson, Ms. Nixon, and Ms. Carter, and they wanted to focus attention on women once more, because we have done some backsliding. They were all there. From Abzug to Weddington, from Steinem to Ferraro, from Coretta Scott King to Sandra Day O'Connor. And in many ways, I felt like a veteran who'd come back for a meeting of the VFW. You know, we were recounting our old war stories and telling about our wounds and being reunited with old friends. And I wasn't one of the generals in the war. I'm not going to tell you that. I was a foot soldier. I just slodged my way through enemy territory, talking to anyone who would listen to me. What I did for love, you would not believe. I gave a razorback hog call in Arkansas. I ate by candlelight with Teamster bosses in Missouri. I do not want to discuss where Jimmy Hoffa's buried, so don't ask me. I auctioned off my husband's underwear at a fundraiser in Arizona. The good news is that he was not in them at the time. And in Salt Lake City, I got there around Mother's Day, and almost instantly I became very unfunny, and my books were taken out of the windows of the bookstores and went to that big garage sale in the sky. But love us or hate us, I just don't think there is one woman in this entire world who has not been affected positively by what we did. The column that I write had to reflect all of that. And so people have traveled with me through the age of Aquarius and the day Barbie went corporate. and through Betty Crocker's three facelifts. The flower children went off of the 60s. They went off to college, taking with us all of our linens and beddings and cars and appliances. I know when our kids left with, you know, the station wagon full of stuff, my husband said, why do they have to take all this stuff and go away to school? And I said, because they're getting away from our materialism. The latchkey kids were born, kids who had their own door key at 5, operated a microwave oven at 4, and had their first word at age 3, and the word was Jordache. And we're up to 77 million baby boomers who used to save animals they couldn't pronounce, drove BMWs, voted Republicans, and said wonderful things like, you all have a good day now. The older mother emerged. They always fascinate me somehow. I can just see them entertaining their kids by having them connect liver spots on their hands. But and then there was that somber day of April 19th of 1987 when I opened my paper and realized that women were being allowed to join the Rotary Club. It was a big moment in my life. I looked at that and I thought, boy, as a feminist, I have been cursed, I have been picketed, I have been held up to ridicule. I had been told to go home. There was a senator in North Carolina who told me to go home and have babies, and I said, sweetie, I'm between estrogen and death. That's not going to happen. Can you imagine all this? Okay, I did all of that stuff. But to join Rotary, I fell on my knees and said, please, God, please do not make me do this. I think one of the biggest changes that occurred, touch upon it just a little bit, is the institution of marriage. And a philosopher once said, marriage is our last and probably our best chance to grow up, and he probably could be right. If I had known when I walked down the aisle in 1949 that I was marrying a man who would dedicate his entire life to going through the house and turning off lights where there were no people in the room, today I would be Sister Mary Carlotta of the convent. This man is miserable. I figure in 38 years of marriage, the Prince of Darkness has saved us probably 12 cents. Every day of our lives, we fight the battle of it. He goes through, he fiddles with the thermostat all the time, makes me crazy. One morning, I was sitting at the breakfast table, and I turned up the park on my bathrobe. And I said, you know, this is quite ridiculous. I am really afraid to fall asleep. And he looked at me, and he said, nonsense. I mean, you have the body of a 20-year-old woman. I said, I should. That's the year you froze it. Our kids are grown now, obviously. They come home to a house that is no longer occupied by the same people they remember, and this is sort of different for us. We're health conscious now. I mean, we buy sugar-free laxatives, and it's true. And when the phone rings after 8:30 at night, I clutch my chest and say, my God, who would be calling us at this hour? You know how that goes. They come home to parents who sit around watching white rhinos mate on public television, and where all the clocks in the house blink because we have no idea how to reset them when they go out. You people have grown up with technology, and I know this, and I think you're the bravest people I've ever met. There's no doubt about it, but we don't deal with it well at all. The VCR is driving us nuts. We're not only watching television 12 hours out of every day, but we're taping another 12 hours. And then you add to that all the new cassettes, and my husband running from room to room, channel searching, and the movie rentals, and we have had to cut corners because we're not going to live that long. We have 60 minutes down to 30, and 2020 down to 10:10, and anything that we see on World War II we just fast forward it because we know how it's going to end. And I think the kids who are coming home now are very different. They only visit us when they're out of work, out of a job, out of love, out of money, or all of the above. And we're not their contemporaries now. It's really a different feeling. They're confronting me with things. One of them said to me the other day, you know, I will never forgive you for putting me out to play and locking the door when the chill factor was 17 below zero. But some days when they're all employed and their cars are running, I have a real good, warm feeling for the fact that I took time out to have a family. And then other days, I feel I paid an exorbitant price for a bottle of tequila and a reckless night. When I was a kid, I really used to envy people who did these wonderful books of fiction on the Isle of Baghdad or Crete or some such place. And I think, boy, that really takes a lot of talent and skill to really put something like that down. I haven't told a lot of people this, but for years after I began this column, I used to make apologies for it all the time. I'd tell the editors, I know, you know, it's just sort of light fluff, and it's not really hard news, and it's probably not the things that make a difference in people's lives. Well, I have stopped doing that. I've stopped beating myself because I've come to realize something very important, that the hardest thing in this world to capture and to have you relate to it is the ordinary, because that's where all of you live. You're the best critics in the world. You know what it's all about. And when you see something that doesn't transfer exactly the way that you think it should, there's something wrong with it. So I'm sort of happy with my whole life and what I'm doing now. I think you hear a lot of talk about success in the academic world, and I don't think a lot of people have any idea what it is, and most people don't even know when they have it. I started out writing obituaries for the Dayton Journal Herald, and that may not sound like a lot, but I did get them to die in alphabetical order every single day of my life. At 39, I published the first of 8 books. At 42, I made my first comedy album for Warner Brothers, and it sold 2 copies at a JCPenney store in Beirut. At 47, I joined Good Morning America, and where I was a field correspondent for about 11 years. And that was sort of weird, because I remember when they first approached me to do that, they were getting together David Hartman, Nancy Dussault, Rona Barrett, Jack Anderson, Jonathan Winters, Geraldo Rivero, and myself. And I must have laughed for 15 minutes. I said, my God, the idea of those people in the same country at one time just boggles my mind, let alone the same show. But I did have a good time on it. At age 55, I did write and produce a sitcom for ABC called Maggie. And I had to smile when she was mentioning this, because if you went out for a beer, you missed it. I mean, that little baby was canceled so fast. At age 60, I'm at work on another book, and I've just finished my first play. I don't do all these things trying to be a success. I guess I do them because I enjoy the challenge of it, and it keeps life interesting. I tend to quote Woody Allen a lot, whom I absolutely love. And when he was asked if he thought that he would continue to live in the hearts of his fans after he was gone, Woody said, I just want to live in my apartment, which I love. I'm going to leave some time. I cut a whole lot out tonight because I understand this is a question and answer form. So that's exactly what I'll do. I know you have burning questions. God knows I have burning answers. I don't think there's any better way to get off of a speech than to tell you a line that I heard this week in Safeway as I was shopping. I said to the girl, I'm ready to check out now. And she said, honey, we all have to go sometime. So that's it. Okay, I have on high-heeled shoes, so let's get on with it. Anyone have any questions tonight? Terrific. Yeah.
As you, to switch a little bit to a serious topic, we have witnessed even as your columns grown increasingly popular, kind of in the Rosian family. I frankly have the opinion that your humor has been sort of damned in eroding the serious problems in the family that we have in front of you. As with your column, I think it would have been far worse. What is the secret? I assume that most of what I've read, everything you've written, you're great.
When you laugh, it's an aerobic exercise. I've noticed that. Incredible. Yes. Appreciate that. I don't think there's such turbulent times. I'm the perennial optimist. If I'm not an optimist, I'm in the wrong business. I don't see that at all. I think families have changed. I think they've regrouped and they've come back again. But you can't do anything to destroy the family. There's not a lot you can do with it because they'll go off and regroup in a different way. I think a lot of things have assaulted it. There's no doubt about it. But I'm still optimistic. I think it's going to endure. It's going to last. There's just such a strong tie. In the latest book, and I swore I wouldn't do this, Family, the Ties That Bind and Gag. In the latest book, I've alluded to this, that no matter what it is that happens to the family, it's going to endure. No doubt about it. It just is. So I'm real optimistic about it. And also marriage. Yes?
A lot of us here who are women are going to be facing the sort of conflict that many career women have today, little time for family and for husbands. How did you deal with this, and what advice do you have for us to deal with this?
I have some real good advice. I really do. I just wish someone would listen to me sometime. I think what it is, in my era, it was the same thing. You know, we had all these slick magazines, you know, telling us, you know, we were bored, depressed, neurotic, and unfulfilled, all of those things. And I thought, my gosh, you know, we're supposed to do all these things and be all these things, all these people. I got smart very quickly. Just relax and enjoy it. I mean, forget about what everyone else is doing. If you don't have a sense of humor about your kids, you won't have one about yourself, you won't have one about your life. And that has really sustained us. I don't take any of that seriously, including myself. And I relaxed with the kids and I had a good time and I figured, you know, 20 years they're not going to remember if I put a second shine on that bathroom floor or not. I mean, who cares? Who cares? We had toilet tissue spindles that never saw tissue on them. It doesn't make any difference, does it? And I just sort of relaxed and enjoyed it, and I think it sort of paid off because the kids aren't too weird. They're employed. They have their own apartments. And, of course, I walked in my son's apartment and Roach hung my coat up, but other than that, you know... I think it's normal, and my husband, I was blessed with having a husband who was born about 20 years before his time, and he allowed me to be. And a lot of feminists would say, well, why would you ask him in the first place? Because my marriage is important to me, and I want him to want the same things that I do. So we talk things out. We still do that. The kids say the only reason we stay together is to finish a sentence. That is not true. Well, maybe it is. Maybe it is. But with a combination like that, you have to be wanting the same things. But it does work. You just sort of have to have your priorities and shuffle them around from time to time. Some of the things that were important to me at that time are no longer important now. I keep shuffling them around. And I don't know what they talk about, quality time. I still spend time with my kids. But I'm basically a workaholic. I love what I'm doing, and I'm willing to work weekends for it. So the time that I take away for myself, usually. Is there a dry eye in the house? Yes.
You've been very successful in books and television. You mentioned, or Fiona mentioned, they're now working on a play.
I like the column. I like the column because in some weird way, I've always considered myself a newspaper woman. Can you believe that? I do. I like the deadlines. I like to write on deadlines. In fact, I'm going to a new syndicate. I'm leaving the LA Times syndicate, and I'm going to a new newspaper syndicate in April. And I said, you know, I've got to have a shorter lead time. I have 4 weeks that I write ahead now, and I said, it's got to be shorter because I've got to hop on these things. When I see a story, you know, the bells go off and I'm following the fire again. I just want to sit down and do it right now. And one of the things I never got a chance to comment on was the Olympics. And I really wanted to say something about the Olympics because I have Eric Heiden thighs. And I thought, you know, I never want to do that sport. And I looked at the skiers and I thought, no, I don't want to do a sport where there's an ambulance waiting at the bottom of the hill. That is stupid. And I finally figured out that the real sport that I think is really going to be a comer for women is going to be the luge. And I think it's true. The reason why women are going to pick up on the luge is because when you lie flat on your back, your stomach is flat. It's just going to take over like crazy. And I wanted to do stories on that. And my lead time was not realistic about it, and I couldn't do that. Or I will sit and think, boy, this is going to be great, and by the time I get it out, Andy Rooney's done it, you know, last week. So it's going to get better. Yeah. Anyone else? Yes. I screwed up somewhere. I don't know. I saw that too, and I thought, what was that, a bad year for me or what? I don't know. I got no respect at all that year. It was terrible. Who's Glenn Thompson? Glenn Thompson is an executive. Every one of you should have a Glenn Thompson in your life. All of you should have a Glenn Thompson. He is an editor who is editor of the Dayton Journal Herald. And he saw my column in a little weekly paper. I got $3 a week for it, called the Kettering Oakwood Times. And he wrote me a letter and said, I'm going to syndicate you. And I said, okay, how much do you want out of it? He said, I don't want anything. And I said, well, you know, you deserve something. The man has never taken one penny for putting this into syndication, for doing all the work. He said it was just the pure pleasure of discovering something and having it fly. And that's what an editor should be about. And I thought that was amazing. He's a good friend. He's still alive, and he still reads every book and bask in the glory of it. I'm very grateful to him. Yeah. Yeah, the play is based on the motherhood book, and they've just found a director. Now I don't know if I want to fall on my face on Broadway or if I'd rather fall on my face on television. It's a big decision for me to make. You know, a first timer going on Broadway has to be out of her mind. You know. I think we'll rent a tuxedo for one night for my husband and see what happens. But that is real risky. It's real chancy. Even if you take it out of town and work your way, you know, back east, it's really difficult. The critics are real tough back here. So I have a dilemma now. I don't know whether or not to turn it into a special for television or not, but it's based on motherhood. Yeah. I wondered when that question would come up. It always comes up. Everyone worries about my kids. I don't know. Who cares? They just, I don't know. You know, I make a living, and I really don't hurt anybody. And I think it's really strange. When I started the column, my youngest child was in the playpen. He was very slow, actually. He was 5 years old. And but he's grown up with it. They all have. And they know something. They know when the fictional character takes over and the real one stops. They know this. And I never really thought about it that much until I was with one of them one day and someone said, oh, are you the one who? And then they, you know, filled in the blank. And I thought, oh, my God, people think this is for real, all of it. Most of it is. I didn't have to elaborate or embroidery too much on any of it. That's the truth. All you have to do is just be a really keen observer and be a little nuts to laugh at it. And that's the combination. But the kids are okay with it. And I don't call them by name. I don't publish their ages. And I never get in close to their personal lives. Not, you know, the dating or anything like that. No, that's hands off. I just don't deal with that at all. Yes, sir.
You mentioned that one or two of your colleagues help all the veterans so forth, and I'm wondering who might be one or two other colonists, humorous or otherwise, who are you particularly respect
on? Well, there's not a whole lot of us around, to tell you the truth. There are some local women. I saw a list, you know, we started keeping a list at home of the imitators that we had, and there was a spiritual Irma Bombeck and a rural Irma Bombeck and a menopausal Irma Bombeck, which I thought was redundant, but, you know, there's a lot of that. There is no one at a national level. The men, I do respect Buchwald a lot. In fact, I was we're a very close group because there isn't anyone else who does what we do for a living. And I was in New York, and I was signing some books in a Doubleday bookstore. And someone brought me a little card and said this had been slipped under the door the night before. And I looked at the card, and it said, "Irma, this is my town. You have 24 hours to get out of it, or you will never see Judge Bork alive again." Signed, Art Buchwald. I'm amazed that no one has asked me about Arizona's governor, who is fighting for his life as we speak. Have you all been following that? It's rather incredible because I brought along some of his wonderful quotes. I keep them with me because I just can't believe them myself. I get them out once a day and go through them. One of Governor Meekham's quotes is, "I'm not a racist. I've got black friends. I employ black people, not because they're black, but because they are the best people who applied for the cotton picking job." And this one I loved. CBS Evening News asked if the governor would give him the true version of a story. And he answered, "Don't ever ask me for a true statement again." And this one I still haven't figured out. He said, "I haven't been getting any positive criticism from anyone." I don't know what positive criticism is. I still think that he's probably the only governor who's going to be making license plates for his own car, but other than that, that's it. It's an interesting case. It really is. He's waltzed in a new attorney now from the East, which goes over real big in Arizona. Anyone else?
Is your husband as funny as you are?
My husband is a hoot. Yeah, he is. He would have to be. I mean, he's got to hang in there. I tell everyone he keeps me real humble and in my place. Whenever I get to feeling pretty good about myself, he will come home from the library and he'll say, "Hey, Irma, I was just in the library, and all of your books are in." Wonderful man. That's why I never traveled. I'm sorry? No. Just issues. I have a local woman who ran against Governor Meekham that I stomped for, Carolyn Warner. I have been asked to run for president. Did you know that? It hasn't gotten on the wire yet. It's true. Some man in Ohio got to sit down figuring all this out and figured I was Democrat and the race was, you know, so full anyway. Why not one more? So he said he was going to run me for president, and I wrote him back and said I really was overqualified and would have to take a cut in salary, so I didn't would not choose to run. Was there a question over here? Did I see someone? Yeah.
Can you tell
Yeah, American Cancer. The next book is really obviously not a book of humor, but it's certainly not a book on death. It's something that is needed by a lot of people. It's a book on children with cancer, and the kids are helping me write it. And it's a story about life and survival. And I'm getting my information from the kids at camp. And there are a lot of cancer camps all over the country. And I go up and visit with the kids and talk with them. And they are so honest and have such spirit. They are amazing. They're not uncomfortable with it, and I'm not uncomfortable with them. The first 3 months, I cried a lot. That's all I did. I read the letters, and I cried. I read letters, and I cried. And I thought, this is nonsense. You know, how can you do a book on kids like this if you're going to fall apart? And the more I visited with them, the more positive I got about it. And I'm okay now, and I think they deserve all of it. And they're going to get the best book I know how to write. And I'm taking the pages to New York of the first three chapters now, so it's on its way. Yes?
You mentioned working for ERA and that there is a need to help. What differences do you see in feminist movement now and then and the environment in which it's fighting? And maybe you could also mention something about the campaign.
About what campaign? I don't know too much about her campaign. I come from another direction. And I will preface it with this. Just because there were different factions of the feminist movement, I hated the criticism that we all couldn't agree. You know, men never agree on where to have lunch, so what are we talking about here? That to me was not a weakness as far as I was concerned. I was never a member of NOW because of my stand on abortion. I'm opposed to it. I'm a Catholic. That was difficult for me. So I came from another direction. I came from ERA America, and I worked under their banner. When I saw Ellie in Atlanta, I hadn't seen her in a long time, and she did tell me about their plans to reword the 27th Amendment. And I think this is wonderful. I think we're going to have to get started all over again. However, I still feel that, in my mind, that this will have to come from another direction. It will have to come from one of those conservatives out there who couldn't possibly vote for it before. It has to be their idea this time. I don't think it can go that same route again that it went before. I think there's too much opposition. I don't think the Eagle Forum was that formidable. I don't think Phyllis Schlafly was that formidable. I think she just sort of touched upon a group of women who probably looked at some women who looked very strident to them, some women who were very powerful to them, and they said, they're not like us. Yes, they are. We are all alike. We are all mothers. You add up our kids, you add up our time in the utility room, you add up our marriage years. Yeah, we're just like they are. But they don't see that. And I think it does have to come from a conservative camp. And be brought in again. And we don't have any momentum now. We've lost it. We have lost the momentum, and we have to get that going again. Because people, I don't see any candidate except Jesse Jackson who is saying, you know, women's rights. No one else is mentioning it. It is not politically prudent to do so. So they're not using us. They don't need us. And I'm not sure that we're a full-blown coalition at this point. Wish we were. Yeah. Yes.
I'll be the first one to use this.
Oh, this is going to be big, isn't it?
He's right there.
You poke a lot of fun in your humor at things that happened during your marriage. Whether I'm making a mistake or not, I'm getting married.
And oh, I'm so glad.
No, but. Most of my friends tell me that I'm too young.
How old are you?
I'm 24. All right, well, and a lot of my relatives tell me I'm too young. In fact, in today's world, it says, today's society says, wait, keep your options open, go out and don't get tied down too soon.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember reading an article in Newsweek by Robert McFarlane's wife. It was within the last year. I don't remember when it was published. And she wrote that people today are getting married too late because they don't have time to share the things that they accomplish along the way. They're not sharing it with anybody. So I was going to ask you whether you think people are getting married too young or too old today. And then I said to myself, no, I know what she's going to say. She's going to say...
What's she
going to
say? I'll make a note.
Well, I thought you were going to say that people, you might say that people are waiting too long, that there's a lot of good that can come out of marriage. And then I started thinking about your type of humor. And in your humor, it seemed to reinforce a lot of traditional values.
Traditional isn't any particular age.
Well, I have to confess, I don't know that much about you. I've never heard you described as a feminist before, and I haven't read all of your works. I've read your article, your newspaper stuff, and when I read it, it's funny. And when I read the funny little things that happen to a housewife or whatever, it's more disarming feminism than feminism. And I guess this is a long, convoluted way of saying...
I'm getting older, yes.
Okay. Do you think that your humor really helps the feminist movement? Because I don't see this... when I read it, your humor, it's sort
we
of...
We needed it. We needed it desperately.
Yeah, well,
oh, yes. We needed it desperately. I wouldn't follow anyone to the women's room who didn't have a sense of humor. And I think at first the women's movement was so serious about it because they wanted to be taken seriously. And they thought if we smile and laugh, they'll say, well, you know, those women over there, you know, arguing over the check for the watercress salad, you know how they are. And they wouldn't take us seriously. And I'm sure that's why they did it. But to me, having a sense of humor comes out with being pretty sure of yourself, a lot of self-confidence, whether it's marriage or kids or feminist movement or what it is, that comes from confidence. And I have enough confidence in the movement, in my marriage, and in all of that. And as for getting married, you know, I mean, you can't put that in an age group and say, yes, everyone should be married by 22 or 28 or wait until you're 30. You can't say that. I mean, you don't have that kind of control over your life. And if you want guarantees, you have to go live with a car battery, because I mean that's the only way you're going to get it. And it is scary. It is scary. You don't want to miss anything.
Well, I really didn't want to talk about.
Oh, you didn't want to talk about your marriage.
No, no. But when I hear you talking about sorting socks, I think maybe it's my conception of what a feminist is, but someone who pokes fun at it. I laugh at it, and everyone else laughs at it, and then I don't think it's that serious, because it's funny.
You really don't?
Well, no, because it's funny, but if you said, God, this sucks, sorting these socks.
Then
I might take it more seriously.
Let me tell you my reaction to it. In 1964, something like that, Betty Friedan came to town. And I was living in the suburbs that I described earlier. And Betty Friedan came, and she, I got a babysitter for the kids, and we drove downtown, we parked the car, and we run in to this memorial hall in Dayton, and I hear Betty Friedan for the first time. And she's talking, you know, about my life. And it is funny to me. It is funny because someone knew what I knew, and I thought I was the only one who knew it. But the difference was, she didn't laugh. And I couldn't have survived it if I didn't laugh. And I thought, here is a woman telling me what to do. She said, get out of that kitchen, lady. You know, get out and do your number. I can't. I have to live within my own limitations. I can't do that. So she was giving me an option that I didn't have. And I think this is what happened. They said, hey, you know, you're dummies for doing this. I don't want to be told that. So our approach when I went on the road was to say, hey, look, you keep the good stuff you've got. You hang on to it with everything you've got. But you still have options open to you. And you still have a right to be equal under the laws of this land. That's important. And that's what our message was. It wasn't to be better than, or to be way out here, or to put anyone else down. It was simply dealing with, when the laws of this land are written, they would include women. It was just that simple. which wasn't simple at all. And the women loved it. We made a lot of converts along the way, a lot of born-agains. It worked. It really did. But we're serious about it.
Well, okay.
I didn't say that with a smile on my face at all. I'm serious. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Yes.
Did you ever feel any criticism from some of your more militant sisters in the feminist movement?
It didn't get back to me. Some of them never really knew what I was all about. I was always hearing from Gloria, who would want me to come someplace, you know, for some, abortion rally or something, and I kept saying, no, I can't do that. And even on the President's Commission, when we voted, there were always two of us who voted against, you know, because of our views. And that's okay. That's all right. We can dare to be different about that. And the Equal Rights Amendment had nothing to do with the abortion issue. Absolutely nothing. So I was very comfortable with that. No, I didn't get any criticism. They, toward the end, I mean, they could use all the help they were getting. I say toward the end, you know what I mean, when it went down in defeat. Anyone else? Okay? One more. All right, one more.
Have you always been glad that your strokes and my strokes, or did it come a point in your life when you suddenly realized that there was humor in such things?
No, I've always done that. I've been real stupid about it. someone came out from, I'm trying to think which magazine it was, Family Circle, and they wanted to do a story on my struggles. And I said, I didn't have any struggles. I mean, you're not looking at tragedy here. And they said, well, you know, your father died at 9. And I said, you know, a lot of fathers die, you know, when kids are young. It's not too unusual. And they tried to you know, have me as someone who's overcome all this adversity. I didn't have any adversity. You know, most people work their way through schools and stuff. That's no big deal. And we always came from a family that we just had a real good time. And we still are. My mother is a real piece of work. I mean, she is incredible. She's amazing. She went with me to the Johnny Carson show. This was back in the 60s. First, my baptism under fire, the first national television show I'd ever done in my entire life, and that's the one. And my mother said, well, if you're going out there, Irma, and try to be something you're not, then you're going to bomb. But if you go out and just be yourself, you're going to be wonderful. And I said, Mother, you are so right. So I went out, and I was myself, and I bombed so bad. So much from others. But she's a character. She's a real character. She, if she's on a television show with me, she will take over the entire show. She will. That's the way she is. Good family, though. Neat family. Okay, is that it? I thank you all very much for coming. Thank you.